Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Greetings, and welcome to this new episode of New Books Network. My name is Joaquin Rivaya Martinez. I am an associate professor of history at Texas State University and will be the host of this interview. Today, we will be chatting with Dustin Tamakera about his book Cinematic Comanches, The Lone Ranger and in the Media Borderlands, which was published by the University of Nebraska Press this year of 2022. Maruawe, Dustin, good evening from southern Spain, which means, I guess, good morning to you over there in Oklahoma.
Hey, Madowe, Joaquin, yes, good morning from here. Chickasaw, Comanche, Kiowa, Apache, so many other shared contested territories, Norman, Oklahoma.
All right, welcome to New Books Network, and thank you for being with us.
Hey, thank you.
Dr. Dustin Tamakera is an enrolled citizen of the Comanche Nation of Oklahoma and an associate professor of Native American Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He has previously worked at the University of Illinois and the University of Texas, among other institutions. Professor Tamakera holds a PhD in American Culture Studies from Bowling Green State University, and he was a fellow of the Humanities Research Institute at the University of Illinois. He is an interdisciplinary scholar of North American indigeneities, critical media, and sound. He also is a playwright, scriptwriter, and voiceover artist, film consultant, indigenous film series curator, and documentary curriculum guide writer. Professor Tamakera's first book, Tribal Television, Viewing Native People in Sitcoms, was published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2014. It foregrounds representations of the indigenous, including Native actors, producers, and comedic subjects in U.S., First Nations, and Canadian television and other media from the 1930s to the 2010s within the historical contexts of federal policy and social activism. Today, though, we'll be talking about his second book, Cinematic Comanches, The Lone Ranger in the Media Borderlands, which was released last January, just a few months ago. Dustin, if that's all right with you, tell us a little bit about yourself, like where you are from and how you became a scholar.
Sure. Well, in the Namatequap, Comanche language, again, I say, ha, Madowe, the Naniasa, Dustin Tamakera, Nakut Sukani, Nakut Wai, Kusi Okwe. It's good to be with you, Joaquin, and thank you for this opportunity and to the listeners out there for being able to speak about some of this newer work on our Comanche people. And, you know, my history of doing this kind of work, you know, for the people and trying to really counter a lot of the research that's out there about us, that is without us, is to really try to center Comanches and in within these larger, you know, borderlands types of stories. And my own background, of being born there in Comanche Nation Capital in Lawton, growing up mostly just south of there across the Piapasuana or the Red River, about 45 minutes south of there in the Wichita Falls, Texas area, an area where my great-great-great-grandfather, Quanah Parker, was known to travel often and to camp out with some of the white ranchers and the oil men like those from the Burnett family. That's where, you know, I come from. geographically and territorially, and you know, grew up like a lot of folks of being exposed to various, you know, cultural influences and lots of pop culture and television and various musics back in the day, and really carrying those experiences with me on into academia, and you know, working my way through through studies in native studies and English and literature and drama and media. And going forth and really trying to tell some of these stories, the stories that are okay to share, that, you know, to relate back to, you know, to Comanches and to other natives, to non-natives, in these borderland stories that tie so many of us together, and to go forth and to really try to make sure that Comanches are not marginalized any more than we already have been, and to not be relegated to just the background roles, but to rather be very much agents who, you know, with so much creativity and intelligence and flaws and just all the things that go with, you know, with being humans, and to go forth and tell those stories that I like to call being Comanche-centric.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particularly influential figures or any mentors that you that were particularly influential in your case?
Yeah, so as an undergrad, many years ago, you know, I was one of those what I often say wandering undergrads, you know, which is interesting considering that my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Peyton Nakona, you know, and his name often being translated as wanderer, as moving around. You know, in my own case, my own context, there was just almost drifting around and not for sure what I wanted to do, and almost without aim or direction, but knew that it was something creative. There's always been this creativity that that I've inherited from, you know, from the Anglo side and the Comanche sides of my family and lineage. And there was one particular class that I started to take because a buddy of mine was in the class, and so we could hang out more in there. But it became really life changing for me, and that was with the late the professor, the late Dr. Jeff Campbell, there at Midwestern State University in Wichita Falls, Texas, near where I grew up. And he's someone who just really turned me on to knowledge. And I always even had this feeling of, you know, as much as I tried to hide in the back of a classroom and not say anything, I sensed, you know, when he was going to call on me and there'd be this pause as if looking at my name again and saying, Mr. Tomakera, you know, what do you think? And it was, again, just someone who came in and turned me on to knowledge and was just dazzling with the multimedia that he could pack into 50-minute class sessions 3 days a week. And so I'd like to think that, you know, some of what I do today is to honor him and to continue, you know, with his legacy of the good work he was doing. Also, back home there in the Lawton area, my late auntie, Juanita Pataponi, to whom the book Cinematic Comanches is dedicated, to her memory and to her legacy of trying to continue doing this work of storytelling. You know, she was my main cultural teacher, as she was for so many Comanches and even non-natives back home in Lawton. And so it's to think about, you know, the work that she did as an artist, as an educator, as a film festival organizer, as a consultant in film. She, you know, as a poet, she was doing so many of the things that that I'm attempting to do, hopefully in a good way now. And so really want to continue her legacy. Those are a couple of the individuals. There's so many. You know, there's my mom, there's my grandmother, there's, you know, uncles. There's just so many who have helped pave the way for me to pursue education and to keep pursuing education all the way to the doctorate level, and now to try to make use of my voice in creative and intellectual ways as well, obviously in audible ways like we're doing here. Mm-hmm.
So Dustin, you're in a privileged position because you are both a cultural insider to Anglo culture and to Comanche culture. Tell us a little bit about the process of researching and writing cinematic Comanches. What was it like?
That's a good question. You know, there early on, I mean, I knew it had to be relational. It had to be accountable and responsible. And it was to do this work in a way that can honor my ancestors and my relatives today. And for future generations, you know, who want to know more about what it was like in this moment, at least through my perspective, through my experiences, you know, if I could say so humbly. And it was to be really responsible toward Anglos, toward Comanches, and toward also trying to think about, you know, all the other groups, you know, who are in these contested and coexisting borderlands across, you know, what's currently known as West Texas and on into Colorado and down into Northern Mexico and all across Oklahoma, parts of Kansas, you know, this large swath of land, hundreds of thousands of acres that was not named by us, but was named, you know, about us and recognized our presence, known as La Comancheria, of Comanche country. And also to, you know, be thinking about our own migration stories, as I talk about early on in the book, of trying to orient readers into how Comanche-centric this book is trying to be by relating some of our own, you know, one of the accounts of our origins with the Shoshone people up in Wyoming and the Great Basin region and the ones who broke away and became known as Numina or later, you know, as Comanches, and migrating across the Rockies and into present-day Oklahoma. We're a unique people in many ways because Oklahoma becomes this gathering place of forced removals for so many Native folks coming from the Southeast, like the Seminoles and Chickasaws, and coming from the Midwest, you know, like the Shawnees and others. But, you know, and the folks coming from the North, you know, Cheyennes and Kiowas. And while we have, you know, our own stories of forced captivity that we conducted, but that also was imposed upon us, we also found ourselves being put right back at what was already home, right there in the heart of Comanche country, the Wichita Mountains, as, you know, our former chairman, Wallace Coffey, calls it, that heart of Comanche country. And so it's a unique kind of positionality. And for so many of us, like myself, who are mixed, you know, we have models to turn to. My great-great-great-grandfather, Quanah Parker, son of Peyton Nakona, and the white captive turned Comanche, Cynthia Ann Parker, you know, he is like me. He has a Comanche father and an Anglo or white mother. And he, you know, attempted to honor both, an attempt to bridge cultures. And I think that's some of the better work that we can try to do in this world of honoring those who helped us to be here and to go forth and really try to build those bridges. And while staying true to ourselves and to sometimes multiple worldviews and looking at how those can coexist rather than just always being in tension with each other. There's plenty else, tension and violence and heated disputes already out there. And some of our history very much comes from, you know, as a result of borderlands violence. But there's also so many other stories, like I try to tell in this book, of Comanches representing Comanches and going forth and showing diplomacy and showing collaborations. Mm-hmm.
So I understand that's actually that building bridges and giving agency to Comanches themselves, including you as an author, is one of the main purposes of your book. But were there any other goals or or when you set forth in this adventure of writing this book, was there any overarching goal that you had in mind?
Well, you know, thinking even in an academic kind of context, you know, having this interdisciplinary background in media studies and in Native and Indigenous studies, you know, I've long found, even with my first book, Tribal Television, Viewing Native Peoples in Sitcoms that you mentioned earlier, there's this huge field of Native American studies and this huge field of media or critical media studies. And so often the two are not conversing with each other. And I've long, you know, argued that to really better understand a people and cultural ways, that it makes sense, especially in this day and age, and it has for centuries now, among Comanches in particular, to consider, you know, intercultural mixing and pop cultural remixes that, you know, that play out between cultures, and that the lines get really blurred. You know, it's not, as some folks try to argue about Quanah Parker, that once he went onto the reservation, you know, in 1875, that somehow that meant he just assimilated. It was quite the opposite. It was that he recognized certain things in the so-called white world that he could adapt to, and that he was already adapting to, and that he could even honor his Anglo ancestry by doing, but he never stopped being Comanche, you know, and we can point to markers like him keeping his long hair and his braids, but it's also, there's so much creatively and intellectually that he's doing to where you don't just suddenly turn off the past 30, 40 years of one's experiences and one's ways of thinking. And so when we have folks today who think that so many Native folks have just assimilated into a dominant culture, it's just not so easy as that. It's not this linear one-way route, but rather, there's just these circular routes and detours that are constantly happening. And I think, you know, especially for young folks, you know, I know that as a former teenager myself, you know, there can be so much angst and so much insecurity, and it can even carry over into adulthood. But rather, you know, than think someone is lesser than because of maybe how they phenotypically look or how they sound or what language or languages they speak or don't speak, I tend to follow the philosophy of a dear Choctaw friend and relative of mine, Leanne Howe at the University of Georgia, creative writer and professor there. And, you know, she talks about, you know, whatever she's doing, whatever she's saying or how she's being, you know, she's being Choctaw. Like, that's just what it is. And whether that's being at a powwow or being in ceremony, or if it's watching a rerun of the Golden Girls, you know, it's being Choctaw. And it helps to open up a more flexible space of talking about what it can mean to be Comanche. But I also think there can be something of a risky slope there when if I wouldn't want listeners to think, okay, that means just anything I say or do, that's just being who I am. It's like, well, we could say that, but then we've got to also go back to what I was saying earlier about being relational, being accountable, being responsible. So, for example, when I get up in front of students or an audience and I say something that so many Native peoples before me have said, when they say I can speak only for myself, that doesn't really get us off the hook of anything. It just means I can speak only for myself. You know, I may be the one or one of few Native folks that some people in the audience ever encounter, interact with. So I say, you know, I speak only for myself, but I'm still being held accountable to the teachings that I've received. And it may be teachings that I agree with or find certain wrinkles in, but nonetheless, it's honoring, you know, those who have helped pave that way for us to be where we're at, and then to go forth and be who we are. And if along the way that helps in building bridges and it helps bring about some kind of healing to a very hurt world, then I think that can be a good thing to be used in a good kind of way.
All right. So before getting into the nuances of your book, there are a couple of expressions or concepts in the title that may be worth defining or telling our audience about. One of them is the idea of media borderlands and also the very expression cinematic commands. Can you explain what you mean by these two?
Sure. So, you know, media borderlands is obviously playing off of historians' work with borderlands, like your own excellent work, Joaquin, and the work of Pekka Hämäläinen and Samuel Truitt, Brian DeLay, and others of talking about the borderlands, and especially thinking about the late Gloria Anzaldúa and her ideas of borderlands as these spaces, you know, where two or more cultures are sharing and often fighting over shared lands and staking their own claims of jurisdiction over these lands. And it could be the old timers, the indigenous who have long been there. It could be the newcomers. Sometimes that could even be indigenous newcomers. It could be, you know, the so-called colonizers who are coming in and thinking about where these cultures, you know, overlap and edge each other, as some historians call it. And then to add media to the borderlands is to really think then how the borderlands and all those geographies and cultural ways are playing out and getting represented in all kinds of ways in digital spaces, in old media, in new media, and to imagine, if you will, this vast map that would be far bigger than I think what any single computer screen I've ever seen would be able to fully capture, and to start looking at, in this case, where cinematic Comanches, or those who, you know, the Comanches and non-Comanches who have played Comanche roles in film and television and other media, to start putting on a virtual map of where these shows were filmed, where these films took place, you know, in fictional settings and the very real non-fictional locations that they're using. And so to give like one quick example, you know, Quanah Parker, great-great-great-grandfather, starred in an old silent film, The Bank Robbery, you know, filmed in 1907, the same year that Indian Territory, Oklahoma Territory merged to become the 46th state of the Union, known now as Oklahoma. And he was filming it right there in that heart of Comanche country in the Wichita Mountains. And there's so many examples of that happening in the silent era in the early 1900s and 1910s of Comanches, essentially playing versions of Comanches in media borderlands of film that are on location in our homelands and doing that kind of work. And so that's where, you know, I think for me at least, that's where cinematic Comanches begins, is in that silent film era of what Quanah Parker and his children, White Parker and Juanita Parker, went on to do, even in the 1920s in the film The Daughter of Dawn, that were all filmed in Oklahoma, in the Wichita Mountains. And we're seeing now even a return in the past 15, 20 years of Comanches playing Comanches in films, independent cinema, in the Wichita Mountains. And so to look at how those roles play out in the media borderlands is to bring in questions of who is representing whom, you know, who is speaking for whom, who is filming whom. There is, you know, our own phrase of hakara marumata kuitaka, of who is shitting whom, or who is getting one over on another. And it's not one-sided. It's not a one-sided borderlands, media borderlands, just like the borderlands that historians have long been talking about. But rather, there's these circuitous routes that unfold and continue to unfold in film, in television, and other media, in which Comanches do dupe others, you know, they outsmart others. They show some of that Comanche continuity and that ongoing presence and the futurity, all of which I wanted this book to contribute to some of those conversations, and especially for our young people to keep thinking and reimagining, you know, what is possible, because nothing's impossible. in what we can do to strengthen our nationhood. And one way to do that is through these media borderlands, through cinematic Comanches, in the production of the films that the genre that I call Comancheria cinema, of strengthening our nationhood and our expressing our sovereignty and going forth and doing that on our own terms and also in collaboration with others.
Yeah, which takes me to another question, another notion that is very important, especially early on in your book, which is the notion of representational jurisdiction. What is it and why can it be so controversial?
Yeah, it's a mouthful of a term, and I tried to really limit the jargon in this book, and I really appreciated that reviewers, picked up on that. But I also think that there's such a good place for jargon, right? That a term like representational jurisdiction becomes this 30, 40 syllable phrase to somewhat concisely, encapsulate what I'm trying to get at throughout this book, these questions of who represents whom, who's speaking for whom, in what ways, that these things are playing out on screen and behind the camera, in front of the camera and behind the camera, as critics and consultants and producers are putting forth their own ideas and responses to the work. So representational jurisdiction involves all of those folks, and it also includes the actors. It includes the sound folks. It includes everyone who's contributing to filmic discourse, to these conversations about film. In to some extent, it's like everyone is staking a type of claim to how, in this case, Comanches self-represent and or get represented by others. And so representational jurisdiction is somewhat as it sounds, is thinking about the ways in which claims of jurisdiction, of some kind of control and power and agency, is happening through the very representations that happen on screen, as well as representations that writers put forth, the representations that we're speaking on in this interview here today. It's what critics are putting out there. It's all these various ideas, and trying to go forth, in my case, trying to be very proactive with it in unapologetically addressing the various examples that I do in this book, and of how jurisdiction is playing out, from directors to film companies like Disney, to the independent companies of what Comanche filmmakers are putting forth out there, and what academics and writers have to say. But it also, to some extent, it's inevitably reactive, and reactive to the extent of responding to a lot of what we call like the ishakuitap, the bullshit of how Comanches have been represented, and sometimes by folks who, like S.C. Gwynn, who gets a very popular and loud platform out there, and doing this work of kind of a good old boys network that was already unfolding, over 100 years ago in academia. And you have writers like him who are basically rehashing that work today and trying to, make it really colorful and turn it into some kind of Hollywood-like story. And what it does is, it only tells part of the story. And true, any of us, that's probably the best we can do, is tell our parts of the story. But there's also ways to be more accountable and to be especially more relationally accountable. And so when you have writers like Gwynn and others who, straight up unapologetically refused to speak with us, then there's going to be repercussions for that. And there's going to be some backlash. And so hopefully, more listeners out there can recognize that Gwynn is not the be all end all of scholarship or writing, and that Comanche peoples today do have so much to say. And what I can do is listen to them and to learn from them and to go forth and share, what might be shareable. And to use platforms like this and trying to speak back and also speak forth, in telling these Comanche-centric stories that don't hopefully dehumanize us or limit us to just roles of violence. While the violence and warfare are definitely a part of our story, it's also not all of the story, as some writers might try to have us believe.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. So early on in the book, you discussed this, your idea that you previously mentioned of Comancheria Cinema, and how there have been competing visions of the signifier Comanche on and off screen, and often involving Comanches themselves. So before we get into the controversy surrounding the Lone Ranger and the casting of Johnny Depp as Tonto, could you briefly summarize, I know this is maybe too much to ask, but could you briefly summarize how Comanches have been represented in film over the years, and the extent or the limits of Comanches' own agency in those representations?
Sure. You know, I separate it in chapter one. You know, I early on, I do this work of trying to lay out, before we get to the Lone Ranger, as you said, trying to lay out some of the pre-Lone Ranger history. We're looking at about 100 years, over 100 years, actually, going back to 1907 with the film The Bank Robbery, co-starring Quanah Parker, and over 100 years of cinema that leads us toward, you know, more recent productions like Magnificent Seven and The Lone Ranger. And the three takes that I basically divided into, you know, there's take one of listening to the silent era. There's take two on the predominance of Westerns and almost like trying to search for the Comancheria, and often not finding it and finding these rather stereotypical and distorted signifiers of and representations of Comanches. And then there's take three that, you know, is unfolding as we speak, and especially in the 21st century here, of returning to La Comancheria, of returning to Comanche country, and seeing filmmakers who are really trying to do that work and come back to the heart of Comancheria for their filmmaking. And so briefly, you know, take one, working with the silent films, The Bank Robbery, there's a film, The Sign of the Smoke, that Quanah's son, White Parker, is in. There's Daughter of Dawn, that his children, White Parker and Juanita Parker, they both co-star in, Daughter of Dawn, about 1920. You know, there's those kinds of examples that we can look to of Comanches playing Comanches, or in the case of Daughter of Dawn, it was an all Comanche and all Kiowa cast. And part of what was, I think, really playful and humorous with that is you often had Comanches playing Kiowas and Kiowas playing Comanches in that film. But you had an emphasis in critical response to those films as folks taking that as very authentic, which in cultural studies can be a very slippery kind of term. But I also hear where it's coming from, that these are, you know, as one reviewer said of White Parker's performance in Sign of the Smoke, I think he said, this was really real. You know, like this seems so genuine and authentic. And these were, you know, Comanches playing versions of themselves. But it also was probably doing a lot of negotiating with the expectations that were being imposed upon Comanches, and then also Comanches going forth and being themselves. I think when Quanah Parker plays one of the good guys in the bank robbery and goes on to help, if not lead, the good guys in capturing the bank robbers, the bad guys there in who have robbed the bank, the what used to be the real bank of Cash, Oklahoma, and near where Quanah Star Home is the Star House is located. You know, he was some ways playing himself. He was showing himself as a protector of his homeland. But I think he also was being playful with it. I think the who's fooling whom was playing out on camera, such as I highlight in one particular moment of him looking at the camera and even looking like he might halfway smirk at the camera. And for backing that up with some evidence, you know, I went to the Library of Congress, and the folks there at the facilities in Culpeper, Virginia, found the original paper roll of the bank robbery, and they magnified it for me as best they could, and, you know, sent me images of that. And it just held out for this possibility that he was smirking ever so momentarily at the camera. It was Hakara Marumata Kuitaka of who might be getting one over on whom, and almost letting folks in on the idea that he knows, you know, he's not some backwards, uncivilized individual who doesn't know what a video camera is, as some people might think, you know, for Comanches and others back then, but rather he's part of those who are making media. And so that continued on, has continued on throughout cinema, but really with the prevalence of Westerns and John Wayne's star power that starts building up in the 1930s, 40s, and you carry that into the 50s, where you go into the second part of this, where two films come out in the same year. You know, one of them goes on to be considered by some film historians as the greatest Western of all time, and that's The Searchers by John Ford and starring John Wayne. And that film plays into very ultra-violent, hyper-violent representations of Comanches. And there are occasional some humanizing moments, but they really get overshadowed by a lot of just disturbing representations of how Comanches are portrayed in a film that was partly inspired, as the writer of the novel for The Searchers that later got adapted into a screenplay, even the writer himself, you know, commented as Glenn Frankel's research has revealed in Frankel's interesting book, also called The Searchers, about the making of that film, and telling this behind the scenes story and on camera story of The Searchers, and it's of Natalie Wood's character, you know, a young white female being captured by Comanches and growing up among Comanches, very similar to, in generally speaking, the story of my great-great-great-great-grandmother, Cynthia Ann Parker, and her own story of being captured and as a young girl at age 9 in about 1836 and being raised Comanche. But the ending of that film and the so-called ending of Cynthia Ann Parker's real life story really couldn't be more different, in which in the film, John Wayne's character, who plays her uncle Ethan, very sadistic, anti-indigenous, very anti-Comanche killer, you know, so-called rescues Natalie Wood's grown female character and takes her back home. She's resistant at first, but then she's recognizing that this is home and this is where she belongs. Meanwhile, all the other Comanches are annihilated and wiped out. And the only Comanche who remains at the end of the film then is the white female. Whereas for Cynthia Ann Parker's own story, you know, Cynthia Ann Parker, as our oral history repeatedly continues to tell us, when she was so-called rescued by the Texas Rangers from Comanches decades later, you know, she was already married. She has Quanah, she has two other children, and that she was heartbroken and desperately tried to escape her white rescuers and tried to get back to her Comanche people. And it didn't happen, as far as on this earth, of being reunited with, you know, with her son, Quanah Parker, who also was looking for her. So there's these highly problematic and distorted visions, competing visions of how representational jurisdictions playing out in the Searchers and other Westerns, like another one from 1956 that was simply called Comanche, that stars a character by the name of Quanah Parker. And he gets played by an Anglo actor, which I guess in some ways could work. Considering Quanah's own lineage, but at the same time, that's what repeatedly was happening, that non-natives, like German actors in The Searchers, were playing, Henry Brandon was his name, who played the lead Comanche in The Searchers. Repeatedly it was non-natives, especially non-Comanches, who are playing these roles. And then when we fast forward more into the 21st century, we're seeing this return, take three of return to La Comancheria, in which Comanches are again representing themselves on camera. And we also have such a growing number of Comanche filmmakers, Rod Pocawatchit and Jason Asenat, my cousin Juliana Branham here in Norman, going forth and doing this work to tell our stories, to tell Comanche stories, non-Comanche stories of representing and staking representational jurisdiction in independent cinema and through PBS, sometimes through mainstream cinema, through film consulting and production credits, through Gil Birmingham as a Comanche descent actor of what Gil Birmingham is doing by breaking through into mainstream cinema and Hollywood, going forth and telling these stories of sometimes Comanches representing Comanches and also Comanches filming about Comanches. And that's what we continue to see unfold. And once again, this this push for so-called authenticity, of when film crews reach out to me, that's usually the number one buzzword that they use, is they want the truth. They want authenticity. And so then we go forth and we're back to talking about, well, here's my perspective and here's some of the research, but here's also some other folks you should really talk to in a collaborative kind of way, in a community-based way. That's what we're seeing unfold right now, Joaquin, is more communal-based filmmaking.
So that's the core of the book revolves around the 2013 Disney production, The Lone Ranger. Tell us a little bit about the controversy surrounding the casting of Johnny Depp in the role of Tonto, Tonto being a Comanche in this film, and his eventual adoption by Comanche elder LaDonna Harris.
Sure. So that really is what catapulted this book into motion, later, once Comanches, real Comanches, became involved in The Lone Ranger. And so when we back up to about 2008, that's when Disney brought Johnny Depp on stage at one of their big publicity events in Los Angeles. And he came out wearing a Lone Ranger mask and said, they were saying that he was going to be in this new production of The Lone Ranger. And everybody was just assuming, since he's got the mask on, that he must be playing the white title character. And there are a lot of folks who wish that had been the case and been the truth. But he revealed very soon thereafter that no, he would be playing Tonto. And it was going to, at some point, they made the decision to have this be a Comanche version of Tonto instead of Potawatomi, as he often was in the radio or television series, or was just tribeless and almost this pan-native kind of character for all natives, and with the broken English and the sidekick role that he's so known for. And so in this case, Johnny Depp playing Tonto, they wanted to make him Comanche to recognize that since the Lone Ranger is a Texas Ranger, let's go with the people who are most associated, perhaps along with Apaches, they're in Texas, and let's make him Comanche. And then once they bring on Comanche, they hired Comanche consultants, William Volker and Troy from SIA, it's our word for feather, and the Eagle and Feather Repository that they run there in Surreal, Oklahoma to this day, an incredible archive and trove of knowledge that they put forth and continue to go forth with. Once they were brought in as consultants for the Lone Ranger, it was pretty soon thereafter that while they were filming in New Mexico, that my auntie, LaDonna Harris, who has a good relationship with Volker and Troy there at SIA, she heard about Johnny Depp playing this Comanche role. And, you know, she was familiar with some of his previous roles and work in which that he had done, where he played often non-native characters, but also in films like The Brave, where he played a native character. And then in Jim Jarmusch's film from 1996, The Dead Man, in which he played a white character, but was almost like a sidekick to the native character, to Gary Farmer's character. So there's also Johnny Depp's own claims to being indigenous. The folks at SIA had said, you know, on record that, you know, after visiting with him and his family, that, you know, they didn't doubt that there's indigenous ancestry there. And while the tribe that he is affiliated with may be unclear, that he has stories of a great grandmother and, you know, who may very well, you know, been indigenous. And there was just a number of things happening at that time where the Cherokee freedmen, you know, were being disenrolled by their very own people there in Oklahoma. And my auntie was reading about them and reading about Johnny Depp and hearing of his claims to being indigenous, being denied, being rejected, and being ridiculed and scorned. And she was like, you know, he's playing a Comanche. And it's like, she told me in an interview once, you know, she wanted to go do, you know, she said, I want to go do what Comanche women back in the day would have done. We're going to go capture Johnny Depp. And and she did it. You know, she went through a formal Comanche adoption ceremony that was led by Volker and Troy there at Auntie LaDonna's house in Albuquerque. And she essentially captured him. She continued, you know, some of the history of captivity. She did it in a serious and obviously a playful way. But she also, as a longtime activist in Washington, D.C., and as the star of the film Indian 101, LaDonna Harris, that was filmed by our relative, Juliana Branham, for PBS, you know, she is smart. She is very business savvy and astute. And she was also, while playing with history, she also was building up more of cultural capital for Comanches. And while Depp was met with controversy and mixed reactions, she also was met with controversy and mixed reactions. But at the end of the day, she was doing like she does, of building bridges and being inclusive and, in effect, getting to know Johnny Depp. And then that led to her bringing Johnny Depp back home to Comanche country and him visiting multiple times for, you know, red carpet premiere, The Lone Ranger, that was exclusively for Comanche Nation members before the rest of the world got to see it, and coming back home and visiting with our young people and really just trying to build some relationships that she's so known for doing. And so that is when I realized there is so much more to the story of what could be told in cinematic Comanches, so much more than just reducing it to Johnny Depp being cast as an Indian. And then you got the two main camps of people who support that and the people who reject it. And then enter LaDonna Harris from stage left or stage west from Albuquerque, and really complicated things. Mm-hmm.
So focusing on the film itself, to what extent do you think Comanche characters are developed or underdeveloped in the movie?
You know, it's a film that there is so much potential in what it could do. And it's a film that, as my relative Marty Chott Smith says, it has its moments. You know, it's a film that, like LaDonna Harris said of her capturing Comanche, you know, she said seriocomically, you know, we adopted him or we captured him so that we could teach him, you know, how to act Comanche, how to go forth and represent Comanches. And her work, and especially the work of the consultants, there's so much commendable work that they did, that other Native actors on set of visiting with Johnny Depp, Saginaw Grant and Gil Birmingham and others, of what they were doing, you know, the relationships were developing. And I think Depp went in with a very sincere, heartfelt, good intent of trying to humanize the Tonto character and trying to humanize Comanche people. And yet those moments that we see on camera of Comanches maybe outsmarting the cavalry, or, you know, certain Comanche songs that are playing that Volker and Troy helped to set up actual recordings of real Comanches back home that Disney came and, you know, made sure to include and work with. Those moments of hearing that and certain material things that Depp's Tonto carries on his person, those moments at the end of the 2.5 hour or so film too often get drowned out, you know, drowned out by such whitewashing that Disney and the script itself put forth in their own control of so much of the representational jurisdiction. And Johnny Depp becomes someone who is kind of in between these camps of Disney and of the consultants. And while there's these collaborations happening, and while there's stories of folks working together in good ways on set, you know, the final product reduces all the Comanches except for Tonto to approximately just 9 minutes of footage in a over 150 minute film. Tonto is of course in a lot of it, but in some ways it really wasn't his story. I mean, he's the narrator in doing this flashback from a Wild West exhibit, a Noble Savage exhibit that he's essentially breaks out of at the end of the film. But he's doing this flashback narration, and it's so much about the Thaivos. It's about the white folks. And the cavalry once again wins, and they wipe out all of the Comanches except for Tonto. The Comanche women especially are highly marginalized to basically 1 second of a close-up shot of when they see these white villains coming into their Comanche village, and the camera does 1 second of a close-up on them, and then they basically help bring the white villains back to good health, and then they're wiped out by the white villains. You know, it's repeatedly these massacres that happen, and I think part of what was happening was Disney's liberal intentions of trying to say, look at what happened to Comanches, but it presented so many of us, our history, our ancestors, as victims, and as gone, as past tense. And there could be anything but that today of how present we are, over 16,000 citizens strong and countless captives across North America of Comanche ancestry out there. So the film, again, has its moments. And it had possibilities of what it could have went on to do. But I think what we saw was the result of a white director in Gore Verbinski, who is very skilled at what he does, but he told a story that would be something he has probably been more familiar with. And I wouldn't expect him to be able to go forth and tell a Comanche-centric story, given his own positionalities and his own background and the films that he's done. So I think there's also the possibility of if Johnny would come back to Comanche country, and there's other films that can be done with Comanches and with the consultants, with Comanche actors, I think sky's the limit on what could actually happen with that kind of platform and that kind of star power for Comanche people.
Mm-hmm. So speaking as a reader now, to me, one of the most interesting sections of the book is the one where you discuss how different audiences received and reacted to the film. So when it began to garner negative reviews, the film producers tried to counter by highlighting the supposedly good reception that the movie had obtained among what they called the Native American community, right? And I'm putting this in quotation marks. What are the implications of these types of broad generalizations about indigenous people, and how did Comanches in particular react to the film?
Yeah, great two-part question there, Joaquin. You know, they were doing this damage control, right? I remember Armie Hammer, white actor who played the title role, you know, saying, "Oh, but Native Americans love it," right? And I think his sample was limited to about a half a dozen folks. Right. He didn't name names, but I think he was limiting that to the few that he was interacting with, and maybe on some publicity stops, you know, some other natives that they had worked with along the way. But it became yet another example of when Hollywood can hold up the opinion of a few as standing in for the opinion of all. And it becomes dehumanizing and I could imagine to some insulting. True, there are Comanches who been very, you know, responded very positively to this film. And then there have been Comanches who despise this film. And for me, myself, you know, I went into that advanced screening of the film in Lawton, in Comanche country, with ambivalence. And I emerged from the theater with still ambivalence. I came out surprised at some moments of like, hey, there's something happening here. Hey, there's some ties to Quanah Parker with, you know, how the elder Tonto version that Johnny Depp's playing with the old man makeup of how he's appearing. I think, you know, there's some folks who did some research in how they wanted to portray, you know, Comanches. And of course, there's the good work that the consultants did in what they were able to do and what they could try to bring to that film. But again, there is also so much that of someone else's story, you know, others trying to speak for us. And that's what happened in these responses. Armie Hammer and Verbinski and others were as if trying to speak for us in the press and going on Fox News and other platforms and giving a very one-sided picture. So when you enter Comanches into this, there were Comanches quoted by NPR who saying, yeah, you know, they were surprised that the film, it included some Comanche words. They liked hearing it. You know, they were pleasantly surprised. They didn't think they were put down at all. And then there were other Comanches who showed up on, you know, episodes of the call-in show, Native America Calling. And there were other natives who showed up on Al Jazeera television and other outlets talking about this film, saying that, yeah, you know, this film, it wasn't bringing forth the justice that they hoped that, you know, producers were saying that it would do at the end of the day. And so what unfolded was, you know, you have a number of examples where in that chapter, I quote, I would think at least 50 different Comanches, which is still very limited, but I did limit a lot of this to what was unfolding in the media borderlands. That is, in interviews, in conversations I was having, in podcasts, in media, of how Comanches were responding to Comanche representation. And what was happening with, especially with some Comanches, was they were rerouting the conversation from pan-Native American conversations. They were rerouting it from just, you know, one-sided discourse, and they were getting more into the shades of gray, and they were getting more into the nuances of how this was playing out. And they could, you know, it was of course Comanches who could read certain cultural nuances and Comanche-centric representations through this film and give perspectives that I don't think the producers would even know where to begin of how to articulate those kinds of ideas. That would be more of what the Comanche consultants and Comanche critics could do with that film in responding in much more diverse, nuanced ways. And that chapter on audience is just unapologetically privileging what Comanches have to say. And I don't necessarily try to say if something's right or wrong or make judgments like that, but I wanted to synthesize Comanche perspectives into this larger conversation about what Comanches have to say about that film. And it was doing, I hope, the work that my auntie, Nita Pataponi, to whom the book is dedicated, that it was doing what she said of when stories come together, that that's when the magic happens. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was doing with that chapter, of trying to bring so many different stories together from Comanches speaking about Comanches.
Right. And in that sense, I think, you know, in the books afterward, you challenge the simplistic notion of a Comanche rise and fall, right? Instead, you remind the readers that the Comanche story is still unfolding, and you include a call for today's Comanches to continue and to expand their involvement in telling their story through film and media. And as you point out, in ways that are empowering and enriching. So I think mm-hmm. that's an important message there that I really appreciate at the end of your book. So thank you very much for your explanations, Dustin.
Yes. No, thank you, Joaquin.
What are you working on now? Do you have any ongoing projects?
Yeah. So my work, especially in Comanche sound studies, getting ready to do some field work, more recordings back home in the Wichita Mountains that are situated in very competing jurisdictions of Comanche country, of the city of Lawton, and of the U.S. Army base, Fort Sill, a place of forced captivity for us and for Apaches and others, you know, centuries ago. And recording some of the natural soundscapes there, and also the artillery testing, the booms of the cannons and the artillery that resonates very loudly on just about any given weekday there in the Wichita Mountains. And looking at these and listening to these colliding soundscapes of how those are unfolding, and following some of the history of Fort Sill and Comanche people, the Comanche presence there, and even Comanches at Fort Sill, whether imprisoned or whether being stationed there in later years as soldiers themselves. And so looking at those coexisting relationships through oral approaches of critically listening, or what we call as Tavitsianakra, of closely listening to our surroundings. And then I'm also doing a lot of work in indigenous and Comanche theater. Just came off of having a short play premiere at the Autry, at the Native Voices of the Autry Play Festival in November there in Los Angeles, and was glad to see that, you know, it picked up a couple of awards for a short play called 911 Comancheria, and continuing to write a number of short plays, as well as a larger full-length children's play called Comanche Girl on the Moon. That gets into some of my auntie's old animal stories, and is inspired by her painting when Comanche women could fly and animals could talk, and following that through the story of a contemporary Comanche girl who goes to the moon in her late kaku or grandmother's rocket ship to the moon, and mm-hmm. and just various humorous adventures unfold in which she tries to learn about herself and learns about the animals and reclaim some of the relationship with what we call the Namamua, or the Comanche moon, the nightlight that we use to help guide us at night, and to go forth and tell some really more Comanche centric stories, to do that on stage for audiences.
Well, thank you very much for sharing with the audience of New Books Network some of the nuances of your book, Dustin. It has been a pleasure to chat with you, and good luck with your projects. I look forward to interviewing you again soon. Ura.
Oh, that sounds good. Yeah, well, ura. Thank you, Joaquin. Ura haits.
And to all of you, many thanks for listening to New Books Network. Kindest regards, and I'll say goodbye for the present.